Hello, and welcome to the TV Movie Rewind Podcast with Matt and Todd.
Hey, everyone.
This week, we are going all the way back to 1944 and getting to our first Alfred Hitchcock film with Lifeboat. And, we're over 150 episodes. We're only getting to Hitchcock now. I mean, I'm not going to claim I'm a huge fan of Alfred Hitchcock. He is one of my favorite filmmakers, and I like a lot of his movies, but they're not something I think of all that often outside, say, you know, my three favorites, which are Rope, The Birds, and Psycho. Lifeboat may be the best of his underrated films. I don't know why it's not talked about more. I know it was somewhat under-distributed at the box office. There was some fear that the movie might be considered pro-Nazi. I don't know why.
Yeah, that's a weird take.
But it didn't get released. It didn't get as wide a release as most Hitchcock films would get.
Yeah. I mean, I guess we'll get into it, but I don't really get. I mean, is it because he's not like a slavering madman? That's weird. I wouldn't have picked up on that. Yeah.
I wonder if it's because the high society reporter and the rich industrialist are both kind of on his side and defending him at points in the movie.
But I think, I don't know. I think the way the movie posits it, it like sort of, I mean, let's get into it, I guess. Okay. But I don't know. I didn't read. Yeah, I don't know.
So this is an easy movie to describe because it takes place entirely within a lifeboat.
Right.
It begins with we only see the smokestack of the freighter that everybody was on board going down. And we quickly establish that a German U-boat torpedoed and sank the freighter, but the freighter had a deck gun, which also enabled them to destroy the U-boat. So it was basically a Pyrrhic victory. And the first character we see is reporter Constance Porter, played by Tallulah Bankhead, who is definitely the star of the film. Because if you look at the poster, her name is bigger than Alfred Hitchcock and John Steinbeck and everybody else in the cast. In fact, her name takes up almost as much space on the film poster as four other actors' names. I mean, she was a big star at the time, although it had been a number of years since she was in a movie. Hitchcock wanted her. We should also mention that this is based on it was a story written by John Steinbeck specifically for the movie. And like I said, we're first introduced to Tallulah Bankhead as Constance Porter, already on the lifeboat with her steamer trunk and her camera and a lot of other possessions, which kind of indicates that the ship must not have gone down too quickly if she was able to get all this stuff onto the lifeboat, but nobody else got on the lifeboat.
Well, she was helped. Like, someone helped her with their stuff. She mentions that, but it's like, yeah, she's there. She's all, like, ready, made up, ready to go with all of her stuff, as if it was a scheduled, you know, as if this whole thing was scheduled. She was just ready to go. Yeah. Women and children first, I suppose, but no, like, she was, like, really prepared.
And whoever helped her in obviously went off to. I actually think they may.
I hope they survived.
Well, I believe it was Joe, played by Canada Lee,
okay,
that helped her on board, and then probably went back to help other people. But maybe that's when the ship, you know, kind of got a critical hit and went down too fast for anybody else to get on the lifeboat.
Got it.
So she's on there, and the next person we're introduced to is John Hodiak, who plays Kovacs, and he'll be our manly man, leading man of the picture, our American hero, although he's antagonistic somewhat.
Yeah.
But I think he has a justifiable anger.
Yeah, yeah, he's not the, he's all right. In fact, most of the characters are, really. Even Constance is all right. I mean, you get, she's just got like an entirely different, pretty self-centered worldview, but she's not like mean, you know.
No,
like,
but no, that also, really is. It obviously sense, you know, Kovac is obviously our working Joe, you know, our everyday man. So when he sees like, oh, this rich, oppressed woman who immediately, she's in this robot.
Yeah, she does not make a good first impression.
There's people screaming in the water, and she looks down and sees she's got a run in her stocking and is like, oh my God, my life, how am I going to go on?
Right. Right. And then, you know, as soon as she meets, it's Joe, right? As soon as she meets him, she's going on about how like she's so happy because she's like, I wouldn't say she's loving the situation, but she's certainly making the most of it. Because she's happy about all like the picture, great pictures she had of like the lifeboat getting sucked down and the people who looked like, what was it, like fat little penguins or something, you know, yep. in the lifeboat and the, you know, the gunfire, the gunner shooting back at the lifeboat. Like she's, you know, lemons out of lemonade, I guess.
She's got some great footage to bring back.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, and meanwhile, like, Joe's just like, yeah, well, I escaped with my life and, you know, really not much else, but glad this is working out for you.
Yeah. Very shortly, some other people come swimming up to the lifeboat, and as Joe goes to help them in, he knocks her camera with all the footage of it into the water, and of course, that, you know, sets her off like, oh my God, I don't care so much about the camera, but the film footage was irreplaceable.
Yeah, I mean, to her credit though, as we'll find out throughout the movie, you know, as we get through the movie, especially, like, for as much as she seems like she's geared up to be like that character, she's not. Like, she mellows pretty easily. Wouldn't you say? You know what I'm saying? Like, it's not the one note. It's like, while it seems like it's going to be her one note, but it's not pretty quickly. And I think that's good, because that could have got like nauseating and probably undermined the film too. Like you know, she does, you could even tell, like, despite the fact that she knows the danger that she's in, like, she also knows, you know, what her job is. And I guess it makes sense for her to be excited about the photos and stuff, but she's also not like out of touch either.
No. So shortly, we'll just, instead of introducing them one by one, because they kind of get on the boat one by one, but as they come on, we get Henry Hull, who plays Rittenhouse, who is a rich industrialist, owns numerous factories in the United States. William Bendix, who plays Gus, who's one of the crew members of the freighter and has a leg injury. Hume Cronin, who plays Sparks. Stanley Sparks. Sparks is a nickname. He was also a crew member. Canada Lee, who plays one of the porters, named Joe. He's actually was keeping Heather Angel, who plays Miss Bigley, and her baby afloat. They get on board. And who am I missing? Oh, Mary Anderson, who plays Alice, who was a nurse. I don't know if she was stationed on board the ship or if she was heading to Europe to help in the war effort.
Yeah, it's not clear. I don't think they ever say.
Yeah. And you also hear from like both Kovac and Gus that they've, and Sparks, that they've been on multiple ships that have gone down in the Atlantic.
Right. Like I don't think they say when this is taking place, but the movie came out in 1944. So, you know,
yes.
The war is definitely going on. So if the movie takes place, let's say in the early, you know, let's say 43 or 44, it certainly makes sense. I mean, if they're merchant marines, yeah, it would be a pretty much a common occurrence to them. Well, not necessarily getting sunk, but the danger of it for sure.
Unfortunately, they just find out almost immediately that, you know, despite, you know, her, Miss Higley having been clutching her baby the entire time, the baby is dead. and they kind of give, you know, that she's almost passed out from her own hysteria, and they have to give the baby kind of a burial at sea. It's very sad and emotional right at the beginning. Yeah. And then they find the last person who crawls onto the boat is played by Walter Slezak. And we find out he's a German.
Yep.
Who was, you know,
Kriegsmarine. Yep.
And they bring him on board, and at first he's all like, Danke, Danke. And Kovac immediately is like, throw him back overboard. Whereas, you know, most of the other people are kind of indifferent. Like, well, you know, we're all kind of in the same. Well, we're all literally in the same boat.
Right.
And Rittenhouse and Porter, Tallulah Bankhead, are both like, we can't do that. You know, there's civility. He's like, and Kovac's like, he sunk our ship. He killed all these people. And they're like, oh, well, you know, we're at war. You know, we sunk his ship. You know, that he did what he was supposed to do, which to me is like, I really admire your neutrality here, people.
Right, not the instinct just to strangle him. Yeah.
No, exactly. After you just had to put a dead baby
right
overboard because of what this guy did.
Right.
And you know, again, the well, let's take a step back and let's all gather our breath. No, I would have been with Kovac almost immediately. Throw him back overboard, and if you want to, you know, try me for a war crime, if and when we get to shore, you go right the hell ahead.
Right. One of the things too I noticed about the movie in general is they don't talk about the wreck much. Like right after the beginning, like they don't really talk about it much, or even any of the other, you know, the hundreds of people they just lost.
Well, again, for most of these, for at least three of these guys. It's we've been there, done that.
Right.
You know, we've kind of acknowledged this as a part of war. I would have been right with them for throwing him over the side, but you know, most of them are like, let's just relax. We're going to try to make our way towards Bermuda, and we can just hand him off to the authorities when we get there. So. You know, everybody starts, you know, trying to settle in.
You could say they made the legal decision.
Yes.
Which does have its point. I mean, when Sparks is talking about it, I mean, he's making a solid point. I don't know how much I would have resisted throwing him overboard myself.
Well, and again, technically at this point, he is their captive. And
right.
He is supposed to be
like they're doing the right thing.
Prisoner of war and do the right thing, which is where most of the people are kind of just standing. And a lot of people is just like, you know, I don't know if I could just kill this guy.
Right.
Who's, you know, technically as defenseless as any of us.
Right.
So basically they kind of like, all right, he'll have to be exiled to the bow of the lifeboat. And, you know, just sit there and be quiet and not bother the rest of us.
That 2 square feet maybe is your section. Yeah.
And, you know, again, a lot of it is like, well, you know, what's he going to do? Right. He's literally in the same boat as the rest of us. And so everybody starts, you know, introducing themselves, and we get the idea of who all their characters are. And, you know, they're all decent, you know, upright people, except for the Nazi up at the front. And, you know, a little, you know, you can obviously tell there's a flame. There's a love-hate relationship between Kovac and Constance Porter. And a nice little kind of almost a sweet romance developing between Sparks and Alice, played by Mary Anderson. And during the first night, as they're kind of deciding, like, you know, we'll take watches, we're not entirely sure, like, Sparks, who is the best at, isn't a navigator, but kind of knows a little bit about it, is trying to determine their course for Bermuda, and Miss Higley starts getting upset about, you know, she comes out of, you know, she wakes up and is like, where's my baby? And immediately like, we're sorry, but the baby died. Don't you remember? And of course, she kind of does remember, but she's obviously in a state of shock. And then she starts trying to climb overboard to throw herself into the ocean to go look for her missing baby. And they're forced to tie this poor woman down who's hysterical. And if you have any questions about whether or not the Nazi sailor is an absolute scumbag or not, that's settled immediately, because as they're trying to deal with this hysterical woman who's just lost her baby, his reaction is to yawn and lie down and take a nap.
Right.
Now, again, they wouldn't allow him to, they wanted him to stay away, but he's, again, he has no emotion to what's going on, unlike everybody else.
Completely. He's just like, yeah,
whatever, dead baby, I'm taking a nap. They eventually decide that Kovac is going to take command, mostly because he demands it. You know, they're even thinking like, well, why don't we let the German guy be in charge? He's obviously he was probably the captain of the submarine, which they trick him into. Like, you know, she yells out, "Captain!" He goes, "Ah,
ooh," yeah.
You know,
oldest trick in the book, but it worked.
And they're like, he's like, "I don't care if he's a captain or not. We're not putting him in charge. He's our prisoner."
It's a tough call here, because on the one hand, you certainly don't want to trust the bastard. But on the other hand, he does seem to be the only one that might be able to navigate you somewhere. Maybe not where you want to be, but I mean, it's probably better than the open ocean. That doesn't seem to be like an unreasonable thought process. I mean, it's not like one of them is like, "No, I'm a navigator. I know this sea, no problem. We go this way, we're good." In which case, okay, yeah, probably believe in that guy. But all of them are admittedly like, "I don't really know, but he seems to."
Sparks is saying he's pretty sure that, you know, we want to head in this direction.
Right.
To Bermuda. And Constance, who can speak German and translate to the German, asks him which direction they should go, because Sparks says this way. And he's like, "Nein." And he points in a different direction.
Right.
And he's like, you know, why should we trust him? He's probably trying to lead us to one of his other U-boats or supply ships, because he operates in this area and he would know where they are. Why would he want to bring us back to Bermuda? Will he be held captive? And they try to argue, well, he wants to survive too, and Bermuda is getting us to Bermuda is his best chance of survival.
And which Kovac is
remains unconvinced.
Yeah, in which case, like, I think it's kind of naive to think that he wouldn't choose his own supply ship. Like, to me, it would come down to, what is your best chance of survival? And are you okay with that best chance of survival, including the very high likelihood that it ends up on a German supply ship? Because if the answer to that is yes, then do whatever the captain says. If the answer to that is no, then you listen to Sparks and you take your chance.
So they do at first listen to Sparks and go by his course. And unfortunately, during their first, they decide Kovacs is going to be in command. Sparks is going to be the navigator. Alice will be their, you know, nurse, medical officer. Joe will be in charge of their rations, because they have rations of water and food on board the lifeboat. Constance Porter will, of course, be the log keeper. And Rittenhouse and Gus, who, like, has the leg injury and unfortunately can't do a whole lot, will just be, you know, support, I guess. So during the first night, while Rittenhouse is supposed to be on watch, he unfortunately falls asleep. And Sparks wakes up and wakes him up and, like, "All right, what happened?" And he's like, I'm sorry, I fell asleep. If it's a good thing I'm not in the army, I guess I'd be shot." And
As you get older, we've all been there. You know, you're watching a movie. Next thing you know, it's like 4 hours later.
And I can imagine that being in this lifeboat is rocking you to sleep.
Yeah. It's understandable.
And as, you know, the light is coming up and everybody else wakes up, they start realizing Mrs. Higley is missing. And they're like, well, we had her tied down. And they notice the rope is being held taut and gone over the side of the boat. And they realize that in the night, in her distress, she either went searching for her baby and drowned, or, you know, maybe committed suicide, you know, because of her loss. And they all just sit there solemnly looking at the rope until Kovac just cuts it and lets her off to sea. Now, one of the things that, well, first of all, again, since this is Heather Angel's exit from the movie, I should say, she's my Whip-Pistle Award winner. She had the smallest role, but she had a tough role to play, and she played it well, because she's basically got only the one scene, and she breaks your heart with it. She absolutely breaks your heart.
Yeah. I mean, do you want me to do mine?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so I think you went past this part already, because it pretty much takes place when they introduce him. But my Whip-Pistle Award winner goes to William Bendix as Gus Smith, because he's a really good storyteller. I mean, he got me involved with his story of Rosie and Al Margulian and the dance contests, and I felt really bad for him when he realized he was going to have to lose that leg, because he's I felt for him. He was so concerned. He's like, I won't be able to dance anymore, which, again, on the surface.
And my Rosie loves dancing.
Yeah. Like, it just basically, I really did kind of feel where he was coming from. He brought that, like, I would watch that show, you know, with the two of them. Like, it just sounds like I don't know. I'm going with Gus. William Bendix brought so much to that character. I was really involved in hoping he would come out all right, especially
when he was telling his stories about dancing and all that. Yeah. I could actually picture they shoot horses, don't they, in my head. And I could actually see his character there dancing along with the rest of them.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It is an excellent performance.
Yeah.
And it's, again, a sympathetic performance. You feel for this guy who thinks that, you know, the reason that Rosie only loves him because he's a good dancer and, you know, she loves to dance. And if this injury he's got in his leg prevents him from dancing, he's going to lose his Rosie.
And the only clearly, and we'll get more into it as we go, because, I mean, this was technically a backtrack back to earlier stuff with Gus, who, you know, spoilers, I guess, for an 80-year-old movie. You know, he loses his leg. You know, it got injured somehow during the event, and it was going gangrenous. Probably the only useful thing that the captain did was you know, amputate his leg, which...
Let's just get to that.
Okay.
Because, you know, as they're sailing along and Alice goes to check his leg and they unwrap the bandage, we don't see it, but everybody who sees it is like, ooh.
Right. It's almost
well,
like
that's
a,
not good.
Yeah. It's almost everybody gets like, it's almost like one, you know, the reaction in a comedy movie where like someone in the background should start puking immediately, sort of thing.
Yes. And she starts immediately like, this isn't good. And everybody's coming over to look. And even Willie the Nazi stands up, who we find out was a surgeon in Germany before he was put in charge of a ship, says, yeah, it's gangrene and that leg has to come off. We're going to have to amputate it. And everybody's like, amputate it here? Amputate it now? How?
Right.
And they turn to Alice, who's like basically their medical officer, and she's like, if he says he can do it, I can try to help. I know kind of what we need to do, but
right.
If it is coming down to cutting off his leg or him dying, I guess we got to amputate his leg. And of course, Gus is against it. And he's, you know, like he's saying, you know, my Rosie, what about my Rosie? And, you know, Kovac, who's obviously an old friend of them, is like, you know, come on, Rosie isn't like that. Rosie will love you anyways. Like, what do you know about my Rosie? I introduced you, didn't I? Like, no, you didn't. Al Margulian introduced us. And we start getting, it's almost like a Seinfeld-Kramer conversation. If you're a fan of Seinfeld, you kind of know how this conversation is going. And it's actually kind of both heartbreaking and comedic.
Yes.
All at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. Bendix is amazing in that scene, and that's why he gets my award. Like that, like he gets to stand out a little bit in the ensemble, and everything they had him do just really worked.
Well, and Constance, who has a huge bottle of
bourbon she came prepared
in her steamer trunk. Is like, well, let's give him some bourbon. So he's drinking that up and getting drunker and drunker and more argumentative too, while everybody's trying to comfort him. And you know, you get the line like, you know, that Al Maragoulian, he ain't no friend of mine. In Kovacs, like, he ain't no friend of mine either.
You almost want to go find this Al Maragoulian somewhere in Brooklyn and like rough him up and be like, Rosie, wait for him. He's all right. He's coming for it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. You stay away from Rosie.
You stay, you know, yeah.
Gus will be back.
Right.
The real shocker is that, you know, because Kovac has, you know, a folding knife. But it's a folding knife that they're going to have to use.
Yeah, it's a 3-4-inch blade tops.
That they're going to have to use to amputate Gus's leg in the middle of the ocean with him only having, you know, the bourbon to kind of relax him. And, you know, every, you know, is it Rittenhouse that offers up his belt for the tourniquet?
Either him or Kovacs.
Everybody's offering up something, right, for, like, trying, you know, to use for sutures and tourniquets. And, you know, she's like, well, I got tweezers. We can use those for forceps and other things. So, you know, you see them heating up the knife with a lighter to sterilize it. And unfortunately, just as they're starting to do this, the weather starts getting rough.
Right. And the tiny ship is tossed.
Sparks is at the rudder trying to keep its cold hold and steady, doing everything he can, holding his whole weight against this. Yes. And the ship is going all over the place.
And they're all
and
yelling Kovacs at him.
Is yelling at him, like, hold it steady. Like, what do you want him to do?
They do this. I don't know if this was the first one. This is 44, so maybe. But it's almost a trope now where, you know, there has to be some sort of, there has to be some sort of like sensitive thing, usually an amputation or surgery, that's done on a notoriously unstable thing where they task some poor person with the impossible task of, you got to keep it stable. Like, he's supposed to just keep the ocean calm somehow.
You almost wonder, like, well, maybe you should wait until this blows over. I know it's urgent.
Can
you
wait a few minutes?
Off as soon as possible, but
yeah.
Maybe wait till this blows over.
Because I was waiting for that. I'm like, someone's going to tell him he needs to hold the boat steady. Yep, sure enough. Like, dude, come on.
Well, fortunately, I mean, Gus does lose his leg, but he does come through the surgery. They managed to somehow, you know, suture up the what's left of his leg, and he's alive. He's not doing great, of course. You know, they're all, you know, rougher for rare, but the German got him through it. But you gotta wonder, did he do it just to make himself look better in their eyes? Like, look, I contributed too, and I saved your friend Gus's life.
I think the latter entirely.
Yes.
Like, I had some question in my mind as to whether or not he actually had to do that amputation or wanted to, but like the reaction by everyone seemed to be like, even the people who didn't know knew that was gangrene.
Well, and if they didn't know what they would, it was gangrene.
And the smell.
They knew by looking at that leg, it wasn't gangrene.
Right. So it's like, so I think like that was the one genuine thing that he did, like the one decent thing that he did. Because like throughout the rest of the movie, anytime something awful happens, not that he necessarily does directly, but he's like smiling, he's having a good time. So it's like, I don't know, like to me, it just weird to say, especially for Steinbeck, like, oh, it was it seemed pro-Nazi. I don't read that at all. Makes him look like a sociopath and a psychopath, which I don't know how that would be pro. Like, there's nothing, I don't make him look good just because he helped cut a leg off. You know what I mean? Especially they make him look like such a bastard in the rest of it. Like, I don't
know. And, you know, if he was a surgeon, because we only have his word for it that he was, but again, he was able to perform an amputation.
It worked.
So he probably was. It may just have been his Hippocratic. I don't know if the Hippocratic Oath goes back that far. It probably does. But it may have just taken over him, and it was his instinct that, like, yes, I got to operate on that leg, and I got to do the best job I possibly can.
And as gruesome as it is and as harrowing as it is, this is one of the times where I appreciate it being an older film because we're not treated to like 5 minutes of grisly bone cutting special effects and screaming and stuff, you know?
So as they're continuing on, we see, you know, Willie the Nazi keeps trying to ingratiate himself, you know, once, you know, at first with Joe, and he's already knows that kind of, you know, Rittenhouse and Porter will defend him. And, you know, he's trying to ingratiate himself, and we see that he's got a compass that he's keeping secret. So he knows exactly, you know, where they are and which the direction is going. But he still claims that he doesn't know. Because, again, they're having an argument about, you know, whether they're on the right course or not. And Sparks keeps saying, like, I can't confirm. I don't know. I'm fairly certain we're going in the right direction.
Right.
And Constance Porter says, you know, the Nazis, you know, Sparks says he's uncertain. But the German says it is the wrong direction. And they keep pressing him, and he's even saying, well, I don't want to say one way or another because, you know, I don't want to be blamed and I can't confirm. And they're like, no, yes or no, are we heading the right way? And finally he says, no, we're not heading the right way. We want to go that way.
Which, again, like I said, to me, it goes back before, like, personally, I'm taking my chances with Sparks' navigation. But if you're willing to let the captain lead you to quote-unquote safety, you have to assume you're going to a German supply ship. You'd be stupid not to.
Well, he's also claiming that he's leading them to Bermuda.
Right, but you have to know he's lying. Like, there's no chance I believe him. I guess, again, I might believe he'd be willing to save his own life, but you also know he's definitely turning you over to the Germans if you're trusting him. You have to, or at least that has to be the thought process in your mind. So either you accept that or you don't. I don't, but you know what I mean?
So finally they start, you know, Sparks is like, since is uncertain, Kovacs gets outvoted and they start heading for the Germans' course. Meanwhile, everybody's starting to get friendlier. There's a nice little romance blooming between Sparks and Alice. And Kovacs has made up a deck of cards from slips of paper from Porter's notebook. And, you know, he's playing cards and poker with Rittenhouse and is gaining thousands and thousands of dollars of Rittenhouse's money in the card games. But then the storm hits.
Do you think he marked those cards?
No.
You don't? You think he was on the up and up when he made the cards? Because he is winning at the game that he made the cards for.
Yes, and so it is. There is the possible that, but I think he didn't set out to be playing, you know, for money or whatever. They obviously just wanted to pass the time, so he made up a deck of cards.
Yeah, I agree. And I think he was trying to make them on the level.
I think it would be easy enough to determine, if, you know, if you really inspected these cards, you would be able to determine whether they were marked or not.
Well, I mean, they're torn by hand, so I imagine they're unique to some extent. But, I mean, that's on Rittenhouse for even going there and, yeah, and playing for money and stuff. But, no, I'm with you in that. I believe he was at least trying to be on the level. If by the nature of how they were made, he happened to notice how certain cards were, I think Rittenhouse would have the same advantage. I mean, he's playing the same deck.
So they spend another night at sea. And while Sparks and Alice are having a little, you know, conversation and getting to know each other and falling more in love with each other, Sparks remembers that he was talking to the navigator the night before the ship went down, and he was talking about their course. And now that it's at night and he can see the stars, he remembers that the ship was heading towards Mars. And that was their course towards Bermuda. And now that they're following the Germans' course, he realizes we're heading towards Venus. We're heading out the wrong way. We're heading to open sea. He lied to us. And he goes, well, we'll see about that. And he starts heading his course to Mars. Well, it would take about 30 seconds to get to Mars, but he starts, you know, using Mars as their guide and heads their course towards Bermuda.
Right.
The next day, as everybody's waking up, you know, Sparks and Alice are saying, like, you know what? you know, we figured out last night the German lied to us about the course. And again, Rittenhouse and Porter are both like, well, maybe he was just a little wrong. He says, no, but
yeah, I mean,
when the German asked you the time,
right,
you know, he was looking at his watch. Why would he, you know, need to be looking at his watch if he's asking you the time? And Rittenhouse is like, well, maybe he wanted to make sure his time was right. And, you know, I've often, you know, had a watch of my own and asked somebody else what the time was. Well, Kovacs is immediately like, well, I want to get a look at this German's watch. And the German is the only one who's still asleep.
Right.
And they all turn to poor Joe, the porter, and they're like, Joe, we know you've got, you know, a pass.
Yeah.
And Joe's like, hey, I gave all that up. I don't do that no more. Joe, this is different now. We need you to get his watch off of him. And, you know, Joe's like, no, that's not my life anymore. But they convince him to do it. And he gets the compass from the German, what they think is the watch, and they realize it's the compass. And now Kovacs is steaming. You know, he wants, like, I knew we should have thrown him overboard. This guy lied to us. He's been leading us back to his German supply ship to take us all captive. We should throw him overboard now. And, you know, Willie the Nazi starts waking up and is all like, oh, what's going on? And they're confronting him.
Hello, fellow lifeboat
people.
Yeah.
All of us going to Bermuda.
At the same time, you know? Yeah. All on the same page.
As they're all getting ready to give them what for, a storm hits. And as it's coming crashing down, and, you know, everybody, the sail they've been using crashes down, and water is splashing over the sides of the boat, and they lose their food supply and their water supply. Willie's actually stepping up, speaking English now. They're like, oh, so you speak English now too? And he's barking orders, which they all immediately start following because they immediately realize his orders are going to keep them alive right now.
Right, yeah. It's,
you know, he's like, you know, grab the supplies, keep those, we're going to lose those. You, get over there and you know, get the ship going.
This is like the one acceptable time. That and maybe amputating the leg. Or, you know, evidently anyway.
Well, especially now that they already know they were lying, he was lying to them about the course. But again, it's like, we don't want to die either.
Sure, no. Yeah. You know, batten down the hatches or whatever sounds like a good plan, yeah.
So they lose their water, they lose their food supply, but they do make it through the storm. And you can tell they all kind of feel defeated now, because now Willie is at the front of the ship, basically their accepted commander, and he's rowing the boat in the direction he's going. Rittenhouse is playing little tunes for Willie to sing to.
And, yeah, you know, all that was kind of disturbing. It's like, all right, that's going a little far.
Well, they, you know, they feel they only survived the storm because of his command.
Which is fair.
And they're also
in that situation. It's like, okay, good for you. But that's about as far as that goes.
Well, those who think they're also all physically and emotionally exhausted.
Oh, yeah, no doubt. Well, I'm not saying they're evil or anything. I'm just saying, like, that was jarring.
Really, it's only Kovacs who's still kind of simmering about it. Everybody else has just seemed to be, like, compliant.
This is our life now, like, for as long as we're on this stupid boat. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you know, we're out of food, we're out of water, you know. Now they're even hoping they get to this German supply ship, you know, because they've got no rations.
Right. Right, like, get somewhere. Get somewhere and somewhere safe and alive. Yeah, the sooner the better, right. That's why I'm saying it's like I could understand them wanting to go by the captain's plan either way. And it's just like, look, if you're listening to them, you have to assume he's going to take you to a German supply ship. That's all I'm saying.
Well, they know that for now.
Like, survival is survival. But yeah, now they know for certain, right?
Yes. Poor Gus is so dehydrated, he's constantly trying to drink seawater, and they're constantly having to, you know, take it away from him, saying, you know, it's just going to dehydrate you further. So another night goes by, and Willie's rowing the boat, and the bastard has himself a stash of water and a stash of vitamin pills and pep pills that are keeping him going, which is how he's got the strength to keep rowing. Gus wakes up and sees him drinking and is like, what are you doing? But, you know, again, he's delirious from thirst. He's lost his leg, so he's probably had severe blood loss and is probably partly delirious from that. And so Willie is just like, oh, you're imagining all this. Don't worry. It's, you know, it's not real. And Gus keeps trying to wake up Sparks, saying, Sparks, Willie's got water. He's got food. He's holding out. And Sparks is, again, exhausted and having to sleep. He's like, okay. Goes back to sleep. Well, Willie's having a nice little conversation with Gus and telling him, like, you know, oh, don't worry, you know, we'll get to my supply ship and everything will be fine. And I just want you, we know Gus earlier, he was born with the last name Schmidt, but he changed it to Smith for obvious reasons. And Willie says, Gus, I just want you to do one thing for me. Remember, your last name is Schmidt. And then he shoves Gus overboard into the water, who calls for help. But between his missing a leg, his exhaustion and dehydration and blood loss, he doesn't last more than, I would say, 10 seconds before he goes under and drowns. And just as he goes under and drowns, Sparks wakes up like, Gus, what is it? I heard Gus calling me. And everybody else starts waking up, and they're like, he's like, what's going on? Like, Gus was calling. Where's Gus? And Willie goes, oh, well, he fell overboard, but there was nothing I could do. And now everybody is immediately like, no, wait, what do you mean there was nothing? You couldn't have grabbed him? You couldn't have woken us, one of us up?
Right, the weak, delirious man who could barely move and think. Yeah, you could have just pushed him right back down.
And then they notice Willie's starting to sweat. And they're like, it's funny how you've managed to stay strong. And now you're starting to sweat.
And now perspire,
None of us have the water in us to sweat anymore.
Right, there's like something, I think it's Constance who says something along, who talks about like tears. And she can't cry anymore because she doesn't have any water to cry. Or something. And then, now they see that and they're making that connection. I'm like, hey, wait a minute. How are you even able to do that?
And then he smugly admits, like, before we lost our water, I stashed some for myself. And I also made sure I had vitamin pills and other things to keep me going. You know, but, I'm saving your lives, aren't I? Well, when they realize that, not only has he been lying to them all, which they realize that they're bringing him to he's bringing them to a German supply ship, but now that he's hidden food and water and murdered poor Gus, that's it. The mob charges him with a rage, all except for Joe. Joe holds himself back. And he even tries to hold Alice back, saying, please, Miss Alice, please, you don't want to do this. But everybody else is just beating on Willie and dragging him to put him over the side of the ship. They get him over the side of the ship, but he's clinging on. And Rittenhouse sees Gus's boot, and he grabs that and just starts slamming into Willie's skull. And that's the end of Nazi Willie.
Now, Nazi Willie, as you mentioned before, played by Walter Slezak, scumbag. Not Walter Slezak, but Nazi Willie, and his conversation with Gus just before Gus goes over, how he kind of convinces him to go off into the ocean because there's Rosie,
go see your Rosie. She's
just out there. Go see your Rosie. Like, he is amazing in this. He is really, really good and such a thoroughly hateable villain.
But all through this, again, we as the audience can see it. It's easier for us to see it, and it's easier to understand why, even though Kovacs is against him, you can understand how his charm is undermining him.
He's almost vampiric.
Yeah.
He's almost a vampire among them.
He's got this big smile. You guys can trust me. Come on. I'm in
there. Right.
We're in the same boat. And also, you know what I've been wanting to say this whole time is how incredibly well photographed this movie is, because the entire thing takes place in a tiny little lifeboat, yet nothing seems repetitive.
No.
We get all different angles. And I guess this was, you know, I watched the making of, and they show where they would have, you know, half of the, you know, boat on a gimbal to keep it rocking in front of a backdrop that with the water and ocean line projected on it. And they did some filming in a tank, and they did some filming, I guess, off the coast of Florida. But they really had this all set up and rigged so that they could get different angles and the camera in different places. So the movie remains visually interesting,
right,
despite being on a lifeboat in the middle of nowhere.
Right. It doesn't feel like as much of a bottle as it truly is. Yeah, it does. It does feel like they're in different places, even though they're what, feet away from each other.
We should also point out that all through the movie, every time a new piece of Constant Porter's property is introduced, it ends up immediately going overboard.
Yeah, yeah.
They lose her typewriter, and it gets to the point where she lost her mink coat.
Yep.
Now, granted, she lost her mink coat giving it to Miss Higsley to keep her warm, and she lost it when she threw herself overboard. So she doesn't make too much of a stink about that, thankfully.
And again,
but now the only possession she has left is a shiny bracelet.
Right, and to her credit, and to the credit of the writing, like she's not cartoonish over it. Like, she's obviously upset because these things are important to her, but you don't get the sense like this was the only thing that mattered, like some movies might do. You know what I mean?
No, she's not like, you know, she doesn't insist that people jump overboard to claim her, you know, you risk your life to go get it back.
Yeah, it's she's not like screaming at poor Joe, like, you know, go after it and save every scrap or I'll have, you know what I mean? Like, that's, yeah. I feel like so many movies would have played it that way.
No, but they don't want her to be the villain.
Right, and she's not, yeah. Like, it almost plays off more amusing than anything else.
And the love, hate.
Or angering if you're Kovacs.
The love, hate relationship between her and Kovac intensify, especially over the bracelet.
Right.
You know, where he wants her to take it off, but she refuses because, you know, this, you know, it was given to me by a person. You know, she doesn't even really want to specify who or why. But it's also their last kind of, you know,
thing
she kind of got with her, holding on to.
Right. And I also think it helps to believe that Kovacs could see something endearing in her. Like, I think even he can see that, like, yeah, this stuff is important to her and that's expected, but also she's not like unhinged by it.
Well, and you know, she obviously sees that he has feelings for her as well, and she's developing feelings for him, and they're trying to meet in the middle.
Right. And I think part of what works is stuff like that where he can see, like, okay, she's materialistic, but it's not to the point of like, yeah, she's risking others' lives over it.
So our remaining cast are even more exhausted from their fight with Willie and throwing him overboard. They've expended what little energy they have left. They are resigned to, we're heading on a course to a German supply ship where we'll be held captive and brought to a concentration camp. Especially poor Joe, who's African-American, he won't, you know, be treated very well. Things are even getting heated, like, during while they're continuing to play cards, Rittenhouse and Kovac. And we find out that Rittenhouse is, like, 25 grand into Kovac for bets.
Because
he even keeps insisting of upping the stakes.
Right.
It's Rittenhouse who wants to up the stakes to try to get even. And, you know, Kovacs is like, all right, whatever you want.
Right.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, like, in the case of Rittenhouse, what's amusing about it is that you can tell it's not really about the money. It's the fact he keeps losing.
Right.
I mean, because like 25 grand isn't much to him. He mentions he's worth millions.
Yeah.
So it's not like he couldn't afford the money. He just does not like losing to him.
And Kovacs is even like, yeah, by the time we're done here, I'm going to own one of your factories. Right. And this is how I'm going to run it. And he's like, are you telling me how to run my business?
Yeah.
No, I'm showing you how I'm going to run your business.
Yeah.
And finally, you know, when it looks like Rittenhouse is about to win his hand of double or nothing, the wind picks up and takes the flimsy little cards out of his hands and is like, I can't believe it. And Kovacs is like, well, I had a full house. And Rittenhouse is like, I had four deuces.
Yeah.
But you knew that, didn't you? So they, you know, they almost get into like a physical fight before everybody separates them. But, you know, now everybody has completely lost it. Except for Joe, who seems to have been able to.
Yeah, Joe's keeping a cool head on all this.
He's also trying to just kind of keep himself separate from everybody, you know. Right. And then Sparks and Alice have, you know, blossomed into a nice little relationship where he's even basically proposed to her now. They're all sitting in a huff.
You almost get the feeling like Joe looks at Sparks and Alice as just like, can I be over there with you guys? You guys seem cool.
Yeah.
Like the rest of them, but can you guys seem cool. But then again, I don't want to be like a third wheel because you have a thing going on. So like, yeah, poor Joe. Like he can't be with like Sparks and Alice who are more like his speed because they don't really talk much except to each other. But yeah, he doesn't want to be in the, you know, he doesn't want to be in the middle either.
So they're all sitting there in a silent huff, and Rittenhouse starts saying, I can't believe what I've been reduced to. You know, arguing over cards and being involved in a mob where I threw a man overboard. And that's when Constance finally just, she kind of wakes up and realizes, like, no, we weren't a mob then. We were a mob when we sat and did nothing and allowed Willie to take control of us. And, you know, we outnumbered him. At any point, we could have, you know, taken over and demanded we start heading towards Bermuda. Once we had the compass and we knew the course, we just sat and let him take over. That's when we were a mob, when we sat back and listened to the Nazi, which again is, how did anybody think this was a pro-Nazi film?
Right.
Is it because Willie isn't portrayed as a mad psycho?
That's what I'm saying. Like, you know, that's the only thing I could think of. Is like, what? Because he wasn't a slavering madman? Because there's literally nothing else about it that's pro anything, you know, about anything that he believes in. Like, he's played pretty outwardly and clearly as a villain, along with all of like the smirking knowingness of a vampire who knows he's getting the best of his, you know, dinner mate or whatever. That's a strange take to me. That's a really strange take.
I mean, I guess, you know, again, we were currently at war with the Germans. So I would say, you know, there was probably hesitance to any even slightly positive portrayal of a Nazi.
Any humanization whatsoever. Yeah.
But she rallies them. She's like, no, we're not giving up anymore. You know, we're going to, you know, we're on an ocean and the ocean is full of fish. We'll fish for our food. And everybody's like, well, we don't have any bait. And she holds up her bracelet and she says, you know, this is our bait. And Joe says, you know what? That would make a nice, you know, bit of bait. You know, I think a fish would be attracted to that. And we could do it. She's like, all right, well, be careful because this is my last possession. And they tie it to a spring. And Rittenhouse is like, and we could squeeze the oil out of the fish because that'll even be better than water. And everybody's all excited. You know, I've never tried raw fish before. Well, I haven't. It ain't that bad. They send the bracelet overboard and they're dangling. And we get a nice little underwater shot of this fish floating up to like, yeah, I think I want to bite on that. And he does. And everybody's all excited. They're like, okay, wheel it in, but be careful. And slow. We got it. Slow, slow. And then you see Joe kind of standing back and looking off into the distance and staring as they're pulling the fish up. And he yells, ship. He spotted the ship. Well, everybody jumps up and turns around. They let go of the line, and again, Constance is like, no, my bracelet, and that goes falling to the bottom of the ocean. But they turn and look, and sure enough, there's a ship coming, and it's the German supply ship. And so now there's kind of, you know, like, they're happy they're about to be rescued, but they're really not being rescued, they're being captured. And as they get closer to the supply ship, they see that they've lowered a boat of their own, and there's a German calling out and, you know, calling out to them. And, you know, like one of them, like, well, I think it's Rittenhouse, says, boy, I hope they have coffee on board. And the German yells something out. What did he say? And Constance is just mockingly saying, yes. He said, yes, they have coffee and streusel and sauerkraut and sausage and, you know, and schnitzel. And, you know, they're trying to, they're resigned to being captured in the fact trading, that they're at least being rescued from the boat.
Trading one deadly danger for another, yeah.
Then the supply boat starts signaling something. You know, a horn goes off and the rescue boat stops and starts turning around. They're like, where are they going? Why aren't they, you know, don't they realize they're supposed to rescue us? It's the law of the sea. And that's when they hear a shell coming over the water. And they realize there's an Allied ship out there and it is shelling the German supply ship. But it's also shelling close to them. So they're kind of, now we get this, you know, climax where, as they're trying to get out of the way of the shelling, the German supply ship is actually steaming right towards them. They are about to get rammed and run down by the supply ship. And Sparks and everybody is trying to, you know, get on the rudder and get themselves out of the way. They're paddling as fast as they can as this massive ship is bearing down on them. And they see the rescue boat gets hit by a shell, and that goes up. I mean, it is a spectacular climax to this movie, as you know, they narrowly escape being run down by the ship, and then the ship is shelled and sank. And now they're like, we just got to see the, you know, kind of our own little moral event, seeing this German supply boat that was about to take us captured sunk, and now an Allied ship is coming to rescue us. This is, you know, the catharsis. This is like, we survived, we made it. And then two hands come up from over the side to pull himself up. And everybody goes to his rescue. They pull him over, and it's a young German sailor who's going, Danke, Danke. And then the bastard pulls a gun on him.
Yeah. I mean, in his defense, he pulled. I don't know if he understood them. Maybe he knew English, but I mean, they were debating on whether or not to throw him back overboard. But yeah.
But again, it's like, you know, they get the gun from him, and it's all like, how can you understand people like that? You know, we pull him from the sea, and he pulls a gun on us.
Right.
And, you know, as they realize too that they're about to get rescued by their own side, you know, Kovac is almost like, says to Rittenhouse, like, you know, forget that 50 grand you owe me. And Rittenhouse is like, no, no, no. You're going to get that 50 grand. You want it fair and square. And I've never welched on a bet in your life. Alice accepts Sparks' proposal. So they're going to get married. Constance and Kovacs are obviously going to, you know, build their relationship, especially now that he's somebody who's worth at least 50 grand. I don't have too much hope for their relationship, but, you know, this is a Hollywood movie. They probably live happily ever after. Joe doesn't have to worry about being captured by the Nazis.
I feel like they'll live the life together they were supposed to, whatever that is. Because she's a, I mean, it, you know, she's a bit of an adventurer, like, and I think that's just like another, it made at least enough be like another story for her, sequel. If anything else, you know what I mean? Right. Like, I think I doubt it'll work out, but I think they'll have a good time, I guess, is the way I'll put it.
I have no doubts about, you know, Alice and Sparks living happily ever after.
Yeah. They seem genuine. Not that Constance and Kovacs don't. It just they feel like that would be a different Hollywood story that, you know, is it's probably, you know, a very passionate and like kind of like wild sort of thing. But I doubt they end up together.
Would be an interesting sequel that I would watch.
Sure.
You know, 5 years later, them married.
Another lifeboat.
Again, her still being a reporter and you know, going out to, you know, carry, and him being like, you know, trying to, yeah, it'd almost be like Romancing the Stone.
Matt Sorois's Alfred Hitchcock's John Steinbeck's After Lifeboat.
Beyond Lifeboat.
Beyond, ooh, I like it.
But yeah, this is, this is a great movie, and it really should be, you know, higher on, you know, the echelon of Alfred Hitchcock's movies.
I think it gets forgotten, right? Because as soon as you think Alfred Hitchcock, you think of other movies. I just think it's a good movie in and of itself and stands on its own. And
like
should.
I said, my top three are, you know, Rope, Birds, and Psycho. And then a lot of people are going to go towards Vertigo. And
maybe North by Northwest.
Rear Window. Great movies.
All fantastic
movies. But Lifeboat is right up there with them. And again, it shows Hitchcock's amazing ability to, like, I don't need, like, you know, North by Northwest has these great, you know, chases and set pieces. But Hitchcock proved he didn't need them with films like Rope and Rear Window and Lifeboat. You know, it's the drama amongst the characters. And it's fantastic. And you like and hate everybody in the movie.
This was a great one to revisit. I remember watching it a couple of times when I was younger. It seemed to be on, it must have been on HBO maybe the first time I watched it. But I remember watching this, and I'll get to one of my recommendations. Two of them, I guess. Five Came Back and Flight of the Phoenix, the original one, the OG one, a lot when I was young.
Well, you mentioned Flight of the Phoenix, and I remember us seeing this movie the same place we first saw Flight of the Phoenix, which was on the Movie Loft TV 38, Dana Hersey.
There you go. Yeah, there you go. And I distinctly remember seeing this when I was much younger.
And I think part of the reason this movie came to mind to do this week as well is, you know, if people who follow around know, last week we dedicated it to our recently departed grandmother. She was also a fan of Tallulah Bankhead.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, I think I kind of remember seeing this movie at least once with her, if not for the first time.
I was going to say, I vaguely remember watching it with her as well. I remember seeing this more, this and Five Came Back. I remember seeing it more when I was younger. And then it's just one of those ones that just get kind of forgotten as you get older, because it doesn't get talked about nearly as much until, you know, partly when we started to do this podcast, or just in general, when we talk about movies, we started to think about all of these movies we used to watch and love so much and just haven't thought about in so long.
Well, and that, you know, there's been 40 more years worth of movies and most stations and, you know, other than, for a while, American Movie Classic and still, you know, Turner Classic Movies, not many stations want to show anything that's much more than 10, 15 years old anymore.
Which is understandable. It's understandable. Yeah. You want to go with, you have your audience that gets older either way. And eventually, you know, whatever channel gets into their nostalgia kick. So for us, that's 80s stuff now. And in the 80s, it probably would have been stuff from the 40s and 50s. So I guess it makes sense in a cyclical way.
Yeah, I remember I remember the Movie Loft being leaning more towards this type of movie.
Yep.
With the 8 o'clock movie on TV 56. Leaning towards more contemporary, or if they were older movies, they tended to be westerns and war movies.
Right.
Which is where we developed our fanship of those.
Right.
But yeah, this is a must-see movie. I gotta say, if you're into film, you know, if you're into film, I think by, you know, natural progression, you're into Hitchcock.
Yeah, most likely.
And if you're into Hitchcock, you got to see this movie. If you're into filmmaking, if you want to make a film, watch this movie to show how you can do it without, I mean, this movie obviously had an elaborate budget.
Sure.
But it also shows that, you know, you can do things like a bottle movie, because this could have really kind of been a stage play. It might not have been too interesting to watch people, you know, sit in the boat up on stage but.
Well, plus, like, they, you know, would you have the boat rocking the whole time? That could get nauseating. You know? Yeah. But it certainly could have worked as a stage play or a radio play, for that matter.
Now, I watched the making of, and I guess, you know, Tallulah Bankhead knew she was the star and let everybody else kind of know it.
Sure. There's always one.
And I guess also she was... she was trying to be sober. I guess she was a notorious drinker, and she was trying to be so sober, which kind of, I guess, made her a little bit even more edgy and harder to deal with at times.
Got it.
And the most famous story, because I remember hearing this during the movie Loft, and once you hear the story, you'll remember why I never forgot it from the last time we saw it. Tallulah Bankhead apparently did not like to wear underwear. And to make the ship rock, you know, a lot of times they were in this half thing that was 12 feet off the ground above them. So the crew would have to help Tallulah up into the thing above them. And she wore a skirt.
Right.
But she's not wearing any underwear. And I guess one of the stagehands went to Hitchcock saying, look, you need to talk to her. She should be wearing underwear. And, you know, it's quite shocking. It's quite, you know, and Hitchcock says, well, I don't see where that's any of my business. And two, I don't know if it's a wardrobe or hair and makeup issue. And I guess that was the last he said anything about it. I guess he also said to poor Mary Anderson, who played Alice, who was, I guess, you know, one of the newer ones, and was kind of like searching for compliments and trying to find out, you know, how she could perform better. And she said to Hitchcock, what's my best side? And Hitchcock answered, oh, my dear, you're sitting on it.
Oh, wow. Damn, Hitchcock, my friend.
Oh, Hitchcock was rough. I still remember, again, from The Birds, when, you know, one of the actresses who played one of the school children being chased by the birds.
Yeah, I think I heard the story.
Went to Hitchcock and said, Mr. Hitchcock, I'm just afraid that this bird is going to attack me and kill me. And Hitchcock leaned over and said, that's okay, little girl. If it does kill you, your part in the movie is almost over anyways.
Yep. Yeah.
Hitchcock was a character. And I guess we should also mention that, you know, Hitchcock famously made little cameos in his own movies. And how he got himself in this way is he's in a before and after a diet ad, which he actually did lose 100 pounds while filming the movie. So,
oh, wow.
I don't know if those pictures are actual before and after of Hitchcock. I guess initially he considered being a dead body floating by, but he didn't want to get into the water to do that. So
sure,
he found this as a better way. Anything else to say specifically about Lifeboat?
No, other than it definitely it still holds up. It's still a fun movie. It's not one. It's not the kind of thing they make anymore. As you said, it's one of Alfred Hitchcock's best. But I mean, you kind of forget that watching it because, you know, you, when you think Hitchcock, you think of all of the other movies. So you're expecting perhaps a twists or something like that. But it's not really there. You just get excellent performances. And it was a great one to watch again. Like, I really don't remember the last time I saw this. I know I had certainly seen it more recently than Five Came Back, though.
All right. Well, you already mentioned kind of your recommendation. Why don't you just go a little bit more into those?
Sure. Okay. Well, with the exception of Flight of the Phoenix, and although I did see the remake, and the remake was fine. I'm talking about the original. Five Came Back, Poseidon Adventure, and Towering Inferno as well. All episodes that we covered. So, you know, go ahead and listen to those, I guess, to plug ourselves. But yeah, no, those are my four recommendations.
All right, well, I'm going to recommend Abandoned Ship with Tyrone Power, which also takes place entirely on a lifeboat after a ship sinking. But there's a bit more. After the ship is sunk and Tyrone Power and all the other people pile into the lifeboat, this lifeboat gets overcrowded.
Yep.
And he's an officer on the ship, but a superior officer is also on the lifeboat, severely injured. And he can see that the weather is about to get really rough and, you know, at high seas. And his commanding officer says to Tyrone Power, you're the most able seaman on board. You're taking over the ship. This boat is not going to survive with this amount of people on board. you're going to have to cast people overboard or nobody survives. You're going to have to sacrifice people or we're not all going to make it. And to prove his point, the captain throws himself overboard because he's injured and he can't contribute. And that's what he's basically saying. Anybody who can't contribute to the survival of everybody else, you need to eject. Because when that storm reaches us, the ship is going to go down and everybody's going to die. And that's the dilemma that is faced by Tyrone Power for that movie. Save everybody, or sacrifice people to save, you know, the few, or and who to sacrifice. It's really intense, and it's I'd highly recommend it.
It's been a long time. I mean, I didn't recognize the name, but I definitely recognize the plot. I believe I have seen that, but that sounds really good to watch again.
To go another way into kind of a bottle movie, 12 Angry Men, another sure. fantastic movie, courtroom fantastic, drama. Yeah. Not quite up there on the legal accuracy for what goes on, but it's a great movie. And what else was I going to pick? Oh, Life Pod. I don't know where you would find it. I don't know if it was ever available, but it was an HBO original movie with Ron Silver, and it was basically the science fiction version of this movie. There's a space liner that is destroyed. A few people manage to get away on a life pod, but among them is the terrorist who put the bomb on board the ship that destroyed it, only you don't know who it is. And, you know, kind of plays out in similar fashion. So with that, we move on to you. Do you have a exploitation title for your 42nd Street Theater?
I do. And the title is They Thirst.
Huh. You might think that's a vampire movie.
Vampire, zombie, something, yeah.
I went with, instead of Lifeboat, Death Ship of Nazi Slaves.
Death Ship of Nazi Slaves. All right. I like it.
Granted, people will still love the movie, but I guess if they ask for their money back, I would probably still have to kind of give it to them.
It feels, yeah, yeah. I was going to say, maybe you could, you know, people try to convince people it's one of like the Ilsa movies. I like it, though.
All right, well, now it's time to do Magnificent 7 Degrees, where we connect this movie to the Magnificent Seven in as few steps as possible.
Sure. So Hume Cronin was in Brewster's Millions with John Candy, who is in 1941 with Warren Oates, who is in Return of the Seven with Yul Brynner.
All right, nice. I went with Hume Cronin was in Cocoon with Wilford Brimley, who was in Borderline with Charles Bronson.
Oh, you went with Bronson. See, for some reason, I thought you would somehow end up with Warren Oates like I did.
You know, I didn't consider that direction. But, you know, when I think of Hume Cronin, I always immediately go to Cocoon or...
Sure.
What was that other one with the aliens there? Batteries Not Included.
Oh, Batteries Not Included, yeah. No, I was thinking Cocoon as well. And I was also thinking Wilford Brimley, but it was... I'm not sure what made me think of Brewster's Millions, but I did.
Hey, you got there.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes I will 2 days later think, oh, I could have got there so much easier going this way. But I
sure. just went.
That's the first place my mind went. It worked. I'm sticking with it.
Wait a minute. You know, James Coburn's in that movie.
Yeah. Yeah. There were some times I thought, like, I could have done it in one step.
Yeah.
But, you know, you just... I you know, usually when we pick the movie, I start thinking about it from there. And
right.
usually the less I think about it, the my mind will make the connections on its own easier. But
right.
All right. Well, with that, you know, I want to remind folks that, you know, they can follow us on X. They can follow us on Instagram. They can follow us on Threads. They can follow us on Blue Sky, but I recommend most of all you follow us on Letterboxd. You'll always get to see what movies we've been watching. I do starred reviews, and I do also write out some reviews. If you're a film fan and you're interested in my opinion beyond this podcast, that's where to look for us. All of those, you will find us under Movie Matt Sirois, all one word, MovieMattSirois. I thank you for listening, as always, and hope to have you back next time.
Thank you, everyone.
Stay gold, people.